Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Ned and Constance Sublette, authors of The American Slave Coast, A History of the Slave Breeding Industry. Also, Debbie Lindsay and Philippe LaMancusa, owners of Kitchen Witch, talk about their beloved bookstore's move out of the quarter. Ned Sublette is one of the most interesting writers I know. He's the author of Cuba and Its Music, The World That Made New Orleans from Spanish Silver to Congo Square, and The Year Before the Flood, A Story of New Orleans. Writing with his wife, Constance, he's back with a monumental new work, The American Slave Coast, A History of the Slave Breeding Industry. Ned and Constance, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, Ned, this is an absolutely fascinating, exhaustive, and exhausting book. What hard work. How did all this start?
Oh, my stars. We worked on it for 5 years, pretty much nonstop. I had to take a year out at one point, but Constance kept the research going. But we've been going on it since 2010. I got a fellowship at the C.V. Starr Center for the Study of the American Experience at Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland, which took me a while to learn how to say. And we were in residence for a year there, which allowed us to break most of the ground on it. But then thereafter, just grinding away.
And it covers such an enormous span of history.
It does. What Susan's talking about that y'all can't see on the radio is that this book weighs 3 pounds. It's, I don't know, 700 pages or something, 265,000 words. It's a long book, but I think it reads fast. That was certainly our intention. And it covers 350 years because we start from the earliest colonial times and go up through emancipation. So that's about 2 pages a year. I don't think that's too bad.
No, it's good value, I have to say, for the reader. And it does read very quickly. That's one of the things I love about your work. The general reader is totally swept up into it.
We hope academics endorse our work, enjoy our work, learn things from our work, but we're not primarily writing for a professional audience. We're writing for an audience of people who want to know.
Right. Now, there's one central image that keeps recurring in this history, and it is that of the coffle, the slave coffle. I wonder if you'd explain what that is and how it keeps coming back.
Well, the coffle, we found working on this book that a lot of people don't know that word, so we really began with a description of coffle, which was the number one mechanism by which enslaved people were moved from the source at first in the upper South, Virginia and Maryland, down to the deep South where they were to be put to work. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, coffle is a train of men or beasts. And it was basically a chain gang. And the largest amount of the labor that was transported from north to south was transported in these kinds of chain gangs, which might mean walking every day from can't see to can't see for 5 weeks, whether it was raining, whatever, sleeping on the ground, maybe in tents. It was a brutal, brutal experience, generally in chains or, in the case of women, perhaps rope. But always under heavy guard, heavy supervision. There were other ways that groups of slaves were moved to market. Many were sent by the ocean-going domestic trade on boats that went around Florida and to New Orleans. That's why we called the book The American Slave Coast, referring to the ocean-going domestic slave trade. But slave labor was sent south by every possible method, riverboats, railroads, once railroads existed, but the coffle was the number one method.
Well, it's so shocking. Now, Ned, you've always looked at history with that distinctive eye of yours, seeking out the alternative interpretation or the deeper look. And so this is a history of slavery, really, as a commodities market and how it's been tied to almost every major event in American history during its duration.
That's right. Slavery is not a sidebar to American history. It's central to American history. When we speak of the slave breeding industry, we're not talking about Mandingo kinds of fantasies of stud farm plantations, that kind of thing. We're talking about American slavery was itself a slave breeding industry that benefited from the financialization of people. Every child born increased the capital stock of the South and ultimately the United States, so that if a baby was worth $75 or $100 at birth, that meant that the farmer had that much more credit at the bank. In short, people were capital.
Now, one of the things that comes home to me about this book is what you must have thought as a woman writing about women who were used to breed slaves for economic purposes. I look at that cover and it's kind of shocking. It is shocking when you look at it, this incredibly pregnant woman in a field with a hoe, and it's just a silhouette.
Yes, in an odd way. The circumstances of this cover were my ideas. I wanted a cover that had a pregnant woman working. And this is what our wonderful publishers came up with. She is modeled somewhat on a contemporary illustration of women working in the rice paddies of South Carolina and Georgia on the low coast. And I had also sort of thought maybe a son, but this stomach has got to be very prominent because women, as women generally do, particularly in agricultural communities, always do double labor. And this is what she's doing. She is doing this kind of labor, and her other labor, the labor of childbirth, is also producing wealth for the people that are using this workforce.
Now, I have to say, the most chilling sentence in this book to me was so simply stated. People were money, children were interest.
And that's right.
It just stops you cold as you read along. Now, you divide this story into two separate portions: importation, which began as early as 1619 in Virginia, and then breeding, and that became the basis for interstate commerce. So talk a little bit about those divisions.
Right. Well, we think one of the most important dates in American history, although it's not one that's generally well known, is January 1st, 1808, right, the date that the transatlantic slave trade was prohibited by federal law. That date is in the Constitution, incidentally, the date before which the importation of persons was the Constitution's phrase, the date before which importation of persons could not be prohibited. The Constitution didn't say that the transatlantic slave trade had to end January 1st, 1808, said that it could not end before that date by federal law. And President Thomas Jefferson, who was president in 1808, proactively, as of 1806, began working to end the transatlantic slave trade at the earliest possible date, January 1st, 1808, and it was ended at that date. This was basically protectionism on behalf of Virginia slave owners, who were Jefferson's most loyal constituents. One of the major threads of our book is the power struggle between slave breeding Virginia and slave importing South Carolina, right, for control of the labor supply, of supplying slave labor to the expanding slavery nation. Virginia won. And after 1808, with Africans no longer coming in, definitively by 1820, when the African slave trade is classified as piracy punishable by hanging, and it does seem that that prohibition was well enforced, because it does not seem that there were large clandestine shipments of Africans coming in all through the antebellum era. This made for the transformation of the United States slavery industry from a business based on importation, whose chief beneficiaries were Liverpool captains and African royals, and to a lesser extent, Rhode Island captains, but from importation, it became a completely domestic industry, so that all of the money of the slave trade stayed in the United States. No other place in the hemisphere had this kind of domestic slave trade based on slave breeding, with the exception of Brazil after 1850. This was pretty much a creation of Anglo-American entrepreneurialism.
Mm-hmm. Now, despite, you know, your focus on Virginia and South Carolina, New Orleans and Louisiana are very important to this story.
New Orleans was the biggest slave market. Everyone in New Orleans should remember this at all times. It's the site of one of the most horrific experiences in American history, this vast slave market. And you can still see the traces of it in New Orleans, dealer showrooms. Those buildings, some of them still exist and have been repurposed.
And then you talk a lot about the slave trader Isaac Franklin, for example, and the plantation that is now a very famous landmark.
That's right. The largest slave trader, the guy who built a national business that linked Alexandria, Virginia, Baltimore, Richmond, this major slave supplying area, to the slave consuming area, was a man named Isaac Franklin. And Isaac Franklin built a beautiful mansion in Gallatin, Tennessee, called Fairview, which is still beautiful today. And it's the basis of a country club subdivision with 800 expensive homes. Isaac Franklin also had another set of plantations in Louisiana, one of which he named Angola, and which came to be the name for all of them after the property passed to the state of Louisiana. So Angola Penitentiary was indeed owned by the largest slave trader.
What a story. And then also, of course, you recount the well-known story now of Solomon Northup.
By now well-known because it was made into a movie. There are other slave narratives which would make great movies, and I hope somebody will make a movie as conscientiously as the makers of 12 Years a Slave did, of Harriet Jacobs's memoir, of Elizabeth Keckley's memoir, to say nothing of Frederick Douglass or William Wells Brown. These would be fantastic movies, but it doesn't seem like our American movie industry is able to make them. I mean, 12 Years a Slave wasn't an American production and did not feature American actors, in fact, in the principal roles. Solomon Northup's 12 Years a Slave, which has been very well authenticated, is perhaps the most perfect slave narrative to make a movie out of, because it's very dramatic in its arc. And it's also, interestingly to me, the only slave narrative by a musician.
And what were some of the most memorable places for you to visit personally?
They were all memorable, but one of the most memorable of all, the most sobering experience for me, was the old slave mart in Charleston. It was experienced not only by us, but in company of the other people who had come in. This is a place from which thousands of people, women, men, and children, had been sold away. And it is a very quiet museum. They do not have a gift shop. What they have is a bookshop. They don't have mugs or anything like that memorializing what happened here. But you go through this place, and there are these marvelous cards that explain what you are seeing. And the people who had come in with us, they read every one of them as we did, with great care and attention. And I could see people's faces changing as they progressed through the museum and saw the progress of how this kind of market worked, starting from the gathering of the women, the children, and the men brought to Charleston, where they may have been resold by now the third or fourth time, and where they would be going. It left you just chilled, and I could see that it wasn't only we who were feeling that, but everyone else who had come into this incredible sacred memorial space.
Oh, and that's how people should feel when they finish this book. That's how I felt. I mean, it was...
Well, thank you for saying that. It was chilling a lot of the time.
It is just amazing, Constance. It really is. We've been talking with Ned and Constance Sublette, co-authors of The American Slave Coast, A History of the Slave Breeding Industry. You can meet them Tuesday, November 10th at 6 at Community Book Center, and again Thursday, November 12th at 6 at Octavia Books. Ned, Constance, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. We are so happy that you wish to have us on your program.
I'm very happy to welcome Debbie Lindsay and Philippe LaMancusa, co-owners of Kitchen Witch Cookbooks. Their shop recently moved from 631 Toulouse Street in the Quarter to 1452 North Broad, Suite C, between Esplanade Avenue and Bayou Road. It's a big change for the nearly 10-year-old store. Debbie and Philippe, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan.
Hi.
Tell us how you got started in cookbooks. It was with your personal collection, wasn't it?
Before the big storm, the one that we just call It, I was culinary director of a small cooking school, a place called Culinaria up on Carondelet. But I had been in the field for probably half a century.
Wow.
And I was fortunate to have a mentor early on in my career that inoculated me with the thirst for knowledge by saying to me that as much as I could possibly learn about food, that's how stupid I would be. Because there would be that much more to learn.
Oh.
And he had a huge library. And so in the early 70s, I started collecting cookbooks. And so by 2000, you know, 1999, 2000, when I had come back from San Francisco to open a cookbook store with my daughter, I had 5,000 of my own cookbooks.
Oh,
because,
wow.
Yeah, at one point, I had a job for 8 years as an executive chef, being allowed to cook anything I wanted, anything I could do. Basque, I could do Spanish, I could do Cambodian, I could do South American. They would let me do French, and then the next week I could do barbecue. So all this brought knowledge to me in the form of books. And at the same time, I love books. I mean, to hold a book in your hand is just, and then a book on cooking, you know, what could be even nicer when you're a chef and you have another cookbook? I was in San Francisco. My daughter would roll her eyes when she would see me bringing in more cookbooks. And I would just tell her, someday I'm going to open a cookbook store. And indeed, one day when I was at home with my daughter in San Francisco and I was rolling my eyes saying, I'm opening another restaurant for another set of investors. I'm working 14-hour days. I haven't had a day off in 10 weeks. I'm writing menus. I'm writing recipes. I'm training staff. I'm ordering equipment. And she just held up her hand and said, it's time. You need to go back to New Orleans and open your cookbook store.
Oh, well, now that's a good daughter.
Well, we came back and she left me for a younger man. So the location we had was so terrible that I ended up closing after 4 years and then taking other jobs, one of which was at Culinaria. And when Debbie and I came back from evacuation, we saw this place on Toulouse Street.
No. He saw this place on Toulouse Street. I was like, no, we're not going to do this. And what, 24 hours later, we're at the bank. We're signing papers.
It's like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Oh, we
just
show
one
people.
More job. We can make this work.
So hoping the beer would wear off and he would say
and
no.
10 years
there you
later.
Go,
yeah.
You know, everybody thinks it would be a dream to have a bookstore in the Quarter, but it can't have been all rosy.
There are 7 bookstores in the Quarter.
Yes.
And per capita, that's more than Manhattan per capita. Small cookbook community, we're independently dependent on each other. We put out a map where the map of the French Quarter has dots where all of the bookstores are. So if I don't have a book, I send somebody to another bookstore. Or if they don't have the book, they send somebody to me. Because, you know, by and large, the bookstores that do carry cookbooks are limited. You know, like now we're up to about between 9,000 and 10,000 titles. There can be an obscure cookbook that we have. There's no such thing as a bad cookbook. there are only bad cooks. But you know, sooner or later, somebody's going to come in looking for the exact book that you thought would never sell.
That's true. I've tried to kick some to the curb, and then invariably someone will come in and grab it, and they're just thrilled beyond words.
And sometimes I remember from my book selling days, it happens just after you've touched it or moved it or looked at it. You know, it's almost magic.
It is so true. I mean, really, it happens all the time, and even in restaurants. But you're right about books. I can go and move around some books, dusting, whatever. I'll see a book. It'll kind of strike me. I'm like, oh, didn't know we had this. And invariably, someone will come in and pick it up and buy it. But it doesn't always work because I've tried that trick with the Apicius, which sells for a mere $700, and I go and touch it all the time. It doesn't work with everything.
Don't give up. Don't give up.
Right.
We do sell the reprint quite easily.
Yes.
That one.
So you've had to move all these books to this new location on Bayou Road, which is also kind of a new community for
you. Bayou Road, that area where Pagoda is.
Yeah.
Pagoda on one side and then down the block on Broad where Seasoned is. That's forming a kind of a nexus of the beginnings of a gourmet ghetto, I think.
Yeah.
There's a new place called P. Rose that's opening up the street. A young chef from the French Quarter is opening it. But that whole neighborhood is in transition. It's a mixed neighborhood, and there's a lot of good energy there. And we'll be switching over from more visitor-oriented sales to community sales.
Uh-huh.
And that's kind of frightening.
Yeah.
Because in the French Quarter, you can pretty much depend on the pedestrian trade.
Yeah.
Neighborhoods are going to be a little bit, and especially with the bookstore closing uptown.
Oh,
that's a very
sad.
I mean, when a bookstore goes down, it's like a tree falling in the forest.
I know. It is a loss for all of us. So tell us about the kinds of cookbooks you have.
Good Lord. We got it from Alabama to Asia, from $2 to $2,000. I mean, so we cover everything. And what we don't have, we'll get it. We'll find it for you. Just let us know what you want.
So tell me, when someone comes in and they want the best Louisiana cookbook, what do you tell them?
Easy money. That's
the Bible.
The Bible is Paul Prudhomme's Louisiana Kitchen. The 1984. He gave away all the information. And not only do other cooks pick up on it, but other restaurants have picked up on these recipes. Mm-hmm. The remoulade sauce in there is a blueprint for every remoulade sauce you have in New Orleans. Except possibly, who does the red remoulade? Toujax does a red remoulade.
Uh-huh.
You know, the original remoulade was a mayonnaise based from Escoffier, but the Paul Prudhomme, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, Joanne Clevenger is serving it on her fried green tomatoes. The red beans and rice, gumbo, jambalaya, crawfish etouffee, barbecue shrimp, it's all in there.
There it is.
Not only that, you know, the photographs I'm making a roux, blackening a fish, and his spice mixtures. Took 2 years to write because Paulette Rittenberg, I don't know if you know her.
Yes.
She stood next to him for 2 years. He'd cook, she'd cook, he'd cook, she'd cook. Has it so exact that as one customer told me, I can multiply this recipe by 10 or cut it by a third and it'll still work perfectly.
Wow.
All the spice mixtures, the recipe for sweet potato pecan pie. The book is worth that.
I'm so hungry now. I can't tell you.
We keep selling it. You know, we keep our book scouts busy trying to find used copies so that we can pass them on.
And you sell spice mixes as well.
Mm-hmm. When I worked for Paul at Commander's Palace, those were the early 70s.
Uh-huh.
You didn't work for the chef. You worked with the chef. And so I worked with Paul at Commander's Palace. And at that time, he had two spice mixtures, not 22.
Right.
Had two spice mixtures. One was meat and one was fish. When I left him and opened my second restaurant on Frenchman Street, I thought, well, you know, having your own signature spice mix is not a bad thing. I worked on that spice mixture from 1974 to 1996 to get it to where it is now.
Wow.
And the spice mixture.
That's a lot of work.
The interesting story is that the only other person that knows the recipe is a dead bank robber. I had a sous chef. I was executive chef of a hotel. We nailed this recipe down. But he decided that it was easier and quicker to make money robbing banks than it was to cook. So he went on to rob banks as an occupation. So the only other person that knew the recipe was him.
And
unfortunately, he wasn't that bright. There's this company named Cisco, and they deliver food. Well, one of the drivers had given him a hat that said Cisco on it. And he thought it was the funniest thing in the world, going to rob a bank, calling himself the Cisco Kid. Well, that only works for so long before somebody sees somebody walking into your bank and he's got a Cisco hat in, you know, you're kind of suspicious. Well, in the high-speed car chase, the Cisco Kid went down in flames, and now the recipe is mine.
Ah, my secret recipe. So I have to ask, what is the most expensive cookbook you have?
The first
yeah,
edition, Julia.
First edition, Julia.
The Mastering the Art of French Cooking.
All right.
First edition, that's $2,000.
That's something to covet. It really is. We've been talking with Debbie Lindsay and Philippe LaMancusa, co-owners of Kitchen Witch Cookbooks. You can visit them at their new location, 1452 South Broad, Suite C. And the new shop opened November 1st. Thanks, Debbie. Thanks, Philippe.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guests, Ned and Constance Sublette, discuss The American Slave Coast, A History of the Slave Breeding Industry, Tuesday, November 10th at 6 at Community Book Center, and again Thursday, November 12th at 6 at Octavia Books. Poppy Tooker signs Toujac's cookbook, Recipes and Lore in the Grand Creole Tradition, Tuesday, November 10th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. That's part of Coffee and Conversations, sponsored by the library and the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. Erin Seideman reads from and signs her memoir, Postcards from the Sky, Wednesday, November 11th at 6:30 at Maple Street Bookshop. Rosanna Pansino signs The Nerdy Nummies Cookbook, Sweet Treats for the Geek in All of Us, Friday, October 13th at 1 at Garden District Bookshop. The Southwest Chapter of the Mystery Writers of America, the oldest organization for crime writers in the country, presents Mystery Writers of America University in New Orleans, November 14th at the Windsor Court Hotel. Instructors include award-winning and best-selling authors Laura Lippman, Megan Abbott, Allison Galen, Erica Spindler, and Bill Lofelm. The day will conclude with a panel discussion about finding inspiration and overcoming obstacles, moderated by me. Courses include After the Idea, Dramatic Structure and Plot, Setting and Description, Character, and Writing and Rewriting. For more information, go to mysterywriters.org/MWA-University. The Octavia Books Science Fiction Book Club discusses Philip K. Dick's The Man in the High Castle, Saturday, November 14th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Tamara Ellis signs her young adult novel, Another Kind of Hurricane, Saturday, November 14th at 11:30 at Maple Street Bookshop. There will be a memorial service honoring Mary Stuart Kellogg, co-founding mother of the Maple Street Bookshop. That's Saturday, November 14th at 5:30 at the shop. There will be an open mic reading Sunday, November 15th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Betsy Gamble will be the guest speaker at the November meeting of the Women's National Book Association of New Orleans, Monday, November 16th at 6:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Leonard Pitts discusses his new novel, Grant Park, Tuesday, November 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. Elise Arden celebrates the re-release of her first novel, The Casket Girls, Tuesday, November 17th at 7 at the Boutique du Vampire, 709 First Street. And congratulations to literacy activist Megan Holt and novelist Kent Wascom for making Gambit's most recent 40 Under 40 list. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.